Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. It is 12 minutes after 12 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's a Monday afternoon. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for joining us. A little bit later in the program, we will be joined by Randy Schaefer. She writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. And then later in the next half hour, we'll talk about this study that shows that industrialized cities are poorer on the east side than the west, and they blame the pollution for that, the wind flow. And, there's lots to talk about there, but I don't want to take up too much more time. The Inno boys are in the studio. Jim Dahlke and Will Flanagan, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
What's up, Steve? How are you?
Well, we got the election tomorrow and...
Election Eve.
Okay, so you guys wrote about so many cool sort of election gizmos or tech stories, right? And I want to jump right into that. The Bar Association would publish a list and you could bring it into the ballot box. But now there's this one. Tell me about future states where you can actually have a conversation with the candidate, a sort of a artificial intelligence conversation.
States is an interesting little application. It really uses artificial intelligence to let you chat kind of in real time, quote unquote, with the candidate. So it kind of archives a lot of candidates' past speeches and a lot of their talking points and a lot of their positions on issues, and kind of lets you have a chat with them in real time about different issues. So you can kind of learn about where they stand on certain topics.
Yeah, it, like most chatbots, it uses artificial intelligence, sentiment analysis, and natural languaging processing to take everything we've heard and consumed in all of the transcripts of basically every debate and discussion and packages it into what the candidate would sound like via chatbot. It's a more interesting experience for one of the candidates than the others using, but it is in one it can be a more enlightening policy-based conversation. The other, you can just feel terrible about yourself. But it's a really cool piece of technology, and it's also another example that chatbots are really fun, and people are discovering new ways to use chatbots every day.
As you're saying this out loud, I think one of the first times we all got together, we talked about. Was it Drake? Wasn't there
the Drake bot, the hot bot bling, where an Onion writer basically took all of Drake's kind of moodiness and packaged it into a chatbot so you could have a conversation with a moody Drake. The thing that your listeners don't know, Steve, is that I'm a chatbot.
You are.
There's no human body behind this. This is just a speaker and a chatbot.
And it's going pretty well.
It goes so far so good.
So far so good. We're not all the way home yet. Okay, so I've been living at 538.com. Every day I get up, maybe sometimes four or five times a day.
That's not healthy.
I know. And I go there because that's the Nate Silver website, mm-hmm. the stats guy, and he goes over every day the chances of the Republicans holding the Senate or Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. And I think right now he's got Hillary with a 68% likelihood that she will win election tomorrow. Well, I did not know until I read in your story that there is a local company or startup. Is it at UIC?
Yeah, University of Illinois down in Champaign.
Oh, U of I. Okay, election analytics. Tell me about that.
Yeah, basically, think about the 538, like you said. Think about what the New York Times does. They are measuring the likelihood that Hillary or Donald will win the election, and election analytics does just that. They're working with students, grad students, and undergrad students, and a full-time professor down there, and they've been doing this since 2008, since 538 was doing this, and their accuracy is through the roof. They are just, if not more, accurate than 538.
Okay, so if you want Hillary Clinton to win, take a deep breath. If you want Donald Trump to win, take a deep breath, too. I guess it would impact both of you. Right now, this outfit, Election Analytics, is saying the chances that Hillary Clinton will win are...
99.7%. They are much more favorable to Clinton than some of these other analytics sites are.
And they've been around 100% for a number of months. And so there's a couple reasons why you may not have heard of this this polling piece of data that is really accurate and really good and based on real data is because covering the election is a business, and it's not exciting to hear the number 100%. So a theory is that this kind of poll is often dismissed or not even looked at because it doesn't play to an interesting narrative, which is frustrating because I would have loved to read about 100%.
But if Nate Silver was 100% confident, he would be putting that up too, right?
The election analytics folks throw a little bit of shade towards 538 by suggesting that other polls make it a little more dramatic in the sake of generating page views and keeping the drama of the election process still around.
Really? Would you be refreshing 538 if it's been 100 for 90 days straight?
If I wanted Hillary Clinton to win, I would, right?
Because because after day 40, not to say again that all of this stuff is manufactured for page views. That's not the point. But it's interesting that this poll, that it's been around, honestly, 199%. The entirety
of this run. Okay, but they haven't been around for that long. How can they brag so much about their accuracy?
So, I mean, really, they can look at the data from the past elections. So they can look at what they did in 2008 and 2012, and they were, I think, around 99% in the states that they were covering there. So, right. I mean, they're looking at their track record over the past couple elections.
And they're not partisan, right? Because I just tried to find it, but I think they are more inclined to say the Republicans will hold the Senate than Silver is. I think. I looked at that this morning. So it's not like they're skewing one way or the other.
They are a bipartisan entity down at U of I.
They want to get it right. They just want to get it right.
There's more of these I want to talk about, so we're going to pull a little audible. I'm going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about how you can annoy your friends. And it's like being an Amway salesman, getting your friends to vote. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's the Business Lunch. This is Steve Bertrand on 720 WGN. And thanks very much for listening. I appreciate it. Hope you had a great weekend and a busy week coming ahead. Election day is tomorrow. You know, we're going to talk in the next half hour with Randy Schaefer. She writes about social media for the Tribune. And the lists of conversation is similar. I mean, we're going to talk about the social media from the White House and what happens, you know, when a new president's sworn in and all of that. But right now, talking with the Inno boys, Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke, about a couple of pieces they wrote about election, I don't know, innovation or different companies in the area. It is remarkable how it has changed in the time since I've been covering it, you know, with the data that's available and how they use the data, the campaigns, the media, whatever, and just the regular, like this Vote With Me. Tell me about Vote With Me.
Yeah, Vote With Me is an interesting app. Political analysts and pollsters are trying to sort of figure out the best way to improve the get out to vote effort. The phone calls aren't really working like they used to because nobody has a landline and it's tough for people to pick up their cell phones.
I do, and I really wish you'd all stop calling. My God.
So this is an app that's built by Civis Analytics, which is a Chicago startup, and it's built for Civic Innovation Works, which is a progressive social welfare organization. What this app does is it will generate a list of the 10 people in your own phone contacts who are most likely to vote for a progressive candidate and based on their past voting public record. And it encourages you to then personally reach out to those friends, tell them where they can vote, how they can vote early, and encourage them to vote. So really, it's an experiment.
It gives you like fake scripts, all right? Suggested scripts.
Yeah, so it lets you copy and paste some text. It says, you know, like, hey, you know, Will, go to your early voting location here and vote for this person. So it's really trying to tap into the personal connections.
So you're giving the software access to your contact list. They then take the names and search voting records, right? They're not looking at people's Facebook posts or tweets or things like that.
Right. So what they're looking at is location and their past voting record. So if they're in a swing state, so if, you know, I've got a lot of people in my phone contacts from North Carolina. So right. an important swing state, a battleground state, they're going to pick probably 10 people in North Carolina. And it actually can identify, based on its algorithm, who it thinks is likely to not go vote. So it can prioritize that list of 10 people based on who it thinks won't make it to the
polls.
And
again, is this on voting record?
So this is that and probably other things that they've sort of factored into the algorithm.
It's peer pressure made smart. That is just easy. It's e-peer pressure. And it's also important to note about this app and Civis Analytics in general is we're talking about all these Chicago-made political tech and apps, not randomly. You know, not every city in the country is having a conversation like this, can talk about all of the tech that's being made in their backyard that is impacting the election. That is because, for example, Civis Analytics is founded and run by Dan Wagner, who ran a 54-person analytics team for the Obama campaign.
And the point to be made there is the fact that they're not going to suggest you call your friends and tell them to vote for Donald Trump.
Right. They built this for Civic Innovation Works, who wants to get people to go vote. They're left-leaning voters, right, and people are going to vote more progressively.
Yeah, 100%. But the 08 Obama campaign is known as as kind of a revolutionary campaign in how it used tech and used analytics. It's kind of like last week we were talking about how the Cubs have pioneered or adopted that analytics first approach. There was a great article we talked about, I believe, a couple weeks ago that compared the Obama campaign to this Cubs team and how they really got their hands on all of the data to win. And I think you're kind of seeing that ripple effect. A lot of these people that worked on the campaign are now starting these apps and starting these startups.
Okay, the ones we've been talking about mostly are fun, but if you're looking for guidance for tomorrow to vote, this Ballot Ready is the one to check out, right?
Yes, these are all really fun. Ballot Ready is a terrific service. Ballot Ready is a startup founded by a number of UChicago students. And what it does is it's an easy way. It makes sure that you are informed on every decision on your ballot. You insert your party, your zip code, what you care about, and it packages all this information in a really easy to consume way, so that, listen, when you go, you're voting for the president, you know what that is, and then you're going to go through five pages of names you're not familiar with. And their whole goal, this whole service, is to make sure that you're informed. You're informed all the way down.
Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. You can read more at ChicagoInno.com. Thanks, men.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful election day. Don't eat too much. It's the Business Lunch on 720. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Well, it's Monday, but more importantly than that, it is the day before the election. And more importantly than that, it is 2 days before the quiet. Randy Schaefer is here. She writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. Winter is coming, but the quiet is coming, Randy. It's not going to be far.
Yes. I think a lot of us are looking forward to finding out the results of the election and seeing it be done and over with.
One of the storylines that we kept following, and really he used it well, I think, Donald Trump in Twitter, and then he didn't use it well. And now there's talk, because, you know, Trump's been very much on message for the past week or so. There's talk that his campaign actually took away his Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk being a big word here, social media has played a pretty big part in this election, and Trump's Twitter has arguably been one of the bigger parts of it. Recently, the New York Times created a two-page spread detailing every single thing that the candidate has insulted via Twitter and complemented it with an interactive piece on its site. So to say that Donald Trump's Twitter has been controversial would be a little bit of an understatement.
And he has backed away from it recently, but the New York Times has a serious story out, right, that they took the Twitter away.
Absolutely. Both the Washington Post and New York Times have said that it seems that Donald Trump's Twitter privileges have been taken away. But USA Today just reported that a campaign spokesperson says that's not the case. So it's a little bit up in the air, and people have been using social media clues to figure out what's going on with that.
Well, the proof's in the pudding. Whatever they're doing, whether it's him or his campaign, it seems to be working for them, because he's had not such a bad week in the past week.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's all about the social media and turnouts. The millennials are as bigger now than baby boomers. They don't turn out in the same numbers, but there's real efforts to do that. The Democrats need that more than Republicans, because the millennials tend to vote Democrat more likely than Republican. I can't go on FaceTime now, or Facebook, I should say, without them telling me to go vote.
Absolutely. A lot of millennials are registered to vote, but as we all know, just because somebody is registered to vote, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get out and vote. And so a lot of social media sites and even apps are trying to do their part to remind their user base, mostly millennials, people my age, to get out and vote. Like you, I've received countless notifications from Facebook reminding me that elections are approaching, as if we could forget. And even my Google app has nicely reminded me that it can find my voting location for me and see who and what is on my ballot for tomorrow.
Well, I like the idea, though, that this Facebook page where they come on with notifications and they encourage you to register online or do whatever, and the numbers show it works. From the the Tribune or from Reuters, a reminder on May 16th coincided with 143,000 people registering or updating their registrations online. So, I mean, it just speaks to we turn to Facebook for our social cues, and when it comes to voting or registering to vote, it has a real impact.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Tell me about Facebook Nation. Someone sent me a tweet the other day and said, are you going to wear a pantsuit on Tuesday? Or something. I think it's like Pantsuit Tuesday or something.
Pantsuit Nation.
And then
absolutely.
I hear about this Pantsuit Nation. What's that about?
Well, it started out as a secret Facebook group. One woman was realizing that Hillary Clinton was getting a lot of flack for her pantsuits.
So when you say secret Facebook, what does that mean? You mean like a closed group?
Yes, okay. A secret Facebook group. Actually, there are open, closed, and secret. Secret ones can only be accessed if you have the exact link and you get somebody approves your invite to join.
Ah,
so
okay.
They're not as easy to find as public or closed Facebook groups.
So it's like a North Shore Country Club.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, I got it now.
The digital version.
Yeah.
So there's this fun group called Pantsuit Nation where a woman started to kind of encourage people to wear pantsuits to the polls, and it's taken on a life of its own. There are now more than 1 million Hillary supporters sharing emotional reflections on the first female presidential candidate in this secret Facebook group.
Okay, so I like that it focuses on, it's sort of an affirmative thing, right? So
yes.
If I post something, whether it has to do with Clinton or Trump or the FBI or whatever, right away you've got both sides and it gets very nasty and then I end up taking it down.
Yes, this is a positive point to this election. This group is strictly positive.
And they're not ripping on Trump?
Nope. Polls or posts are very, very closely monitored. And it's mostly just women finding, or not even women, but people who have longed to see this finding solidarity with people several time zones over across the country, even in other countries. So it's a really nice reminder of how we are all digitally connected, even when we're not connected in real life.
So it's Pantsuit Nation, but there's nothing you can do about it, right? I mean, if I wanted to join Pantsuit Nation, short of going to Lane Bryant, what would I do today?
It's not quite a secret anymore, so I'm pretty sure you can Google Pantsuit Nation and you will see.
You'll find the link to it.
Oh, yes. They're pretty easy to find now that the cover's been blown.
Okay, so there's that. We were talking earlier today in the Bill and Wendy show about the states where you could or could not take selfies in the ballot booth.
Yeah.
And I think in Indiana you can. In Illinois, it's not so clear?
Illinois, you currently cannot. I know that in several states, 19, I believe, it is illegal to take polling place photography, and that includes ballot selfies. Illinois is one of those states, and while several states, including Michigan, have started lawsuits, Snapchat has actually jumped on one of these lawsuits to appeal the ban. In the meantime, you should probably just keep it safe and take a selfie with your I voted wristband instead of your actual ballot.
Well, what do you think of that?
I think that it's very interesting. These laws obviously weren't really made for a Snapchat era.
Right.
And this is just one example of the way that things are going to have to change in order to keep up with our 24/7 digitally connected mentality.
See, so I wonder about people who are intimidated to vote one way or maybe paid to vote one way, and this is a way to prove that they did it.
Right.
So that's one argument, I think, against the cameras in the polling place.
Right. That very much is. Yes.
Although I don't really know if that really exists. I mean,
that seems kind of, I'm sure it does.
Yeah. One other thing then, President Obama has sort of been, I think, arguably the first social media president. I mean, George Bush certainly had used social media, but the Obama sort of revolutionized the way it was used in a campaign and then the way it was used in the White House. And there's an interesting story that you showed me about what happens when Obama leaves? I mean, they've got these great databases, they've got these websites, the addresses. What happens to all of this stuff?
That's a good question, and it's a question that a lot of people have had. What happens to the POTUS Twitter, the FLOTUS Twitter, the VP Twitter when Obama leaves office? And the White House has actually recently addressed that. They are going to be working with the National Archives and Record Administration to try to freeze everything in time. The concept of freezing social media in time seems a little abstract, but they're going to do their best. Essentially, this administration is going to be trying to preserve everything online as it's done with faxes and handwritten notes in the past. Everything on the POTUS Twitter account will be moved to a POTUS 44 Twitter account, and the followers will remain.
So the next president gets the...
Yes.
Gets the name POTUS, doesn't get the list of followers.
Gets the followers, doesn't get the previous tweets. So...
Oh, they keep the followers.
Same handle, same followers, completely clean, empty slates.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Randy Schaefer, I appreciate all of that. Thanks for coming by today. And
absolutely.
Do you have a pantsuit? Can I ask you?
I do not, but I might have to stop by Lane Bryant and pick one up before I head to the polls tomorrow morning.
We'll see you again next week.
Thank you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. 1253, it is the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, so there's a study out that looks at big cities, and the ones mentioned in Steve's story are New York, London, Paris, and the idea that the eastern part of the city tends to be less affluent than the western part. I'm not sure how that applies here in Chicago. We'll kick that around. Steve Goldstein is on a phone line from MarketWatch.com. Steve, welcome back to the Business Lunch. Good to talk to you.
Nice talking with you.
Yeah, and so explain this for me, that the idea is that an eastern part of a metropolitan area tends to be less affluent than the western part. I mean, is that not universal, but is it widespread?
Well, it is widespread, and of course, it's not the only factor. But there are two things. One is during the Industrial Revolution, as, you know, cities across the globe industrialized, they did so in a very polluting way, and the prevailing winds in the Western Hemisphere tend to go west to east.
Right.
So the wind blew the pollution from, you know, in these cities, you know, you had all this manufacturing, to the eastern parts of the town. And what happened is people very naturally didn't want to live there. So you had the poorer parts of the population would gather in these neighborhoods, and the more affluent would be on the west side.
And so here we are in Chicago, and, you know, people are going to be saying, well, wait a minute, that's not the case here. There might be a two factors in Chicago. One is the lake is on the east side. More affluent people live along the lakefront than away. But if you travel to the southern part of the city and just southeast of the city, and you get into, you know, industrialized South Chicago and then Gary, that sort of, if you take the metropolitan area as a whole, that sort of applies.
Yeah, and I mean, I actually did think about that for Chicago when you asked if I could join the show. You know, clearly we don't know how the fish think about all this.
Right.
But if you look in many cities across the U.S., you know, not all of them hold to this pattern, but many major ones do. Los Angeles is one that comes to mind. There are definitely some other ones as well in New York. Now, this particular study focused on the U.K., and, you know, they really looked at the cities in England, and that's where they did the bulk of their research.
Steve, I got to tell you, I'm watching on Netflix, there's a new series called The Crown, and I'm just a sucker for those shows. It's about Queen Elizabeth and Philip, and they're right now in the early years of her reign, and Winston Churchill's the prime minister, and they're dealing with this. There was a massive fog in London caused by weather conditions, but coal dust, where 12,000 people were killed. I think it was 1955 because of weather conditions and the emitting dust from coal. So it's something that we'll be dealing with. I sort of got you off track there, but I just thought it was interesting that as I'm getting ready to talk to you, I see a very real example of this. But the point is, this happened during the Industrial Revolution, but the effects remain today. Explain that for me.
Well, so that's a little bit more of a surprise. You know, when they looked at the data, they said, look, the pollution isn't nearly like it is. And you can see that just by going in both the UK and the US. But what they think might be happening is that once this sort of sorting takes place, without, you know, a huge effort, it just tends to stay in place, the power of inertia. And very importantly, they looked, and because it's England, you have a wealth of historical data, they were able to look kind of before the Industrial Revolution. So before that, you didn't see this impact. After, of course, during the Industrial Revolution, you did. But what's interesting, when there were, even after the many decades of cleaning things up, you know, their own version of the Clean Air Act, it still was in place as recently as 2011.
Well, it's a fascinating thing to think about, and it's something that developing countries and cities should keep in mind as well. You can read much more about it at MarketWatch.com. The reporter on the story, Steve Goldstein. Hey, Steve, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You bet. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.